Atheist Nomads, episode 111, Black Non-Believers with Alex Jules. Please note that there is exclusive patron-only content after the outro.
Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's A-R-C-H-W-A-Y hosting.com.
Hey, we're also brought to you by listeners just like you. Find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads.
As a concerned parent of the free thought community, I want to advise Atheist Nomad listeners that this is an adult show. There will be things discussed, talked about, topics that may be inappropriate for children under the age of 25, 40. 26, 27, yeah. 40.
We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. This is episode 111. I am Dustin. Joining me as always is Wesley.
Hey there, how's it going?
And joining us today is Alex Jules. Alex is a black atheist surviving life in Texas, president of the Black Non-Believers of Dallas. On the board with Secular Avenue, has been featured in Ebony Magazine, as well as many other fine news outlets around the world. He blogs at Graffiti Wall and Patheos, and is the funny guy on Dogma Debate. Alex, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
If David Smalley hears this, he's going to kill me. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. The funny guy. Yes.
Don't worry. Nobody listens to us.
So, Alex, let's start with your background, because I know you've got had a fascinating upbringing just to put it bluntly, due to horrible oversights in our scheduling.
Yeah.
The two black people we've had on the show before were both raised Jehovah's Witness. And you've got a bit different perspective. So what was it like growing up?
I grew up in a household, and it was a little different for me. I grew up in New York, where in an Afro-Caribbean neighborhood. I'm Haitian. And, grew up with Jamaicans, et cetera. I grew up in Brooklyn. And I grew up Roman Catholic, right? But it was a very different kind of Roman Catholic. I don't know if a whole lot of people would really recognize this version of Roman Catholicism.
why do I think Santeria is going to be involved?
Unfortunately, yeah. There was a lot of voodoo that was associated with it, right? I mean, it's culturally, it was partly... Yeah, what kept me in the church, quite honestly, I was fascinated with the occult side. You know, you had the light side, you had the dark side, and the occult was absolutely fascinating. In fact, it was really cool. I know the Catholic Church or the Brooklyn Archdiocese would deny it now, but I swear I must have been maybe 6, 7 years old, and there was a woman that came in that was possessed by voodoo demons, and she started, you know, spitting and screaming and what have you. And a Catholic priest, not a deacon, but an actual Catholic priest came out, and he was screaming at her. And I swear I witnessed what was, you know, looked like an exorcism to me. Again, you know, because of the way those things are sanctioned, I'm sure they deny it now. But as a child, can you imagine what that did to me? Oh my goodness. I was sold. I was like, man, this is some interesting stuff. I just saw my first taste of real evidence. You know, I was literally waiting for her to start throwing up pea soup and her head start spinning. I was like, this is my life. And that actually was one of the reasons why I really wanted to be a priest, right? That was something that was heavily ingrained in me as a child, right? This idea of service to the community. Of course, it was an economically disadvantaged or depreciated community, Brooklyn, New York. It's I think 50% of the actual neighborhood that I grew up in had about a 50% literacy rate by the time. Yeah, it was absolutely horrific. I mean, you almost don't want to admit that this is an American city or American neighborhood. But, so there was death, there was all kinds of despair, and we had basically church missionaries that were out there, priests and people that were doing good out in the communities and making people feel better. So that drew me in. Now, my mother didn't like a lot of the Catholic churches or the Catholic schools that were out there. She didn't think that they were, rigid enough. And it's funny because I look at a lot of my now atheist friends. It's like, you were Catholic too? Like, oh yeah, yeah, totally. It's like, yeah, they really do breed a lot of atheists, but they really do. So she decided that she was going to put me in a Seventh-day Adventist school. So SDA school, which was bilingual. It was French and it was English. And that was as early as I can remember. I did pre-kindergarten there. I actually still remember some of these stories from pre-kindergarten. I remember my kindergarten teacher, you know, and having that Bible in the front of the class and people, you know, coming in to read the Bible. I remember one of the challenges that we had is every year we were learning, I want to say it was about 100 different verses, and it had to be part of rote memory. So this was something that my mother thought was great. Unfortunately, as we were talking earlier, there was a lot of corporal punishment that was involved as well, and everyone signed off on it, and parents signed off on it because it was culturally acceptable at the time. And so if you didn't get it, well, you got it, if you know what I'm saying. So there was a lot of, as if religion doesn't have enough fear and carrot in the stick already, here you go. You have the physical manifestation of an all-loving, punishing deity wrapped up in a 5'8" woman who, you know, is just the nicest, sweetest woman until you piss her off.
Mm-hmm. And so this was at an Adventist school in New York?
In New York, yeah. It is still open. It is still open. I looked it up. It is still open. It's in Brooklyn, not too far off of Ocean Avenue and Nostrand, you know, still very much, I want to say, steeped in the old tradition and old ways. But yeah, it's still there.
That was one thing I definitely noticed in my time in the Adventist Church was, now I was in the Northwest, grew up with that. And thought, okay, this is a pretty liberal, or at least moderate church. Then I went to the seminary at Andrews and got to, well, I was a minority at the seminary. Blacks, primarily of Caribbean descent, were probably the largest group there.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And then I found out about how incredibly segregated the Adventist church is. Now, there's really two churches, the white church and the black church.
Mm-hmm.
And
it sounds like the Baptist.
If it's not on the West Coast, it's really frickin' conservative.
Yeah.
And so do you know whether the that school you're attending was through the local conference or the region?
I believe it was the local conference.
Because the conference is the white church. The region is the black church.
Then you know what? I had... Until I left New York, I had not met one white Adventist. How's that one for you? Yeah.
Well, okay. They actually just came out with there was a survey on diversity in across religious groups. Adventists actually came out as the most diverse.
Yeah.
Pretty evenly split, black, white, and Hispanic.
Might be diverse, but you're saying that it's very segregated.
Segregated.
Still.
Very segregated.
Yeah.
And right now, Hispanics are actually losing out the most with the segregation because they don't really fit in either the white church or the black church.
Yeah.
And they don't have the same privileges because with the segregation, you at least know that the leaders overseeing your church, the conference officials, are going to like church similar to the way you do.
Do you think that's something to do with the language barriers between the SDA churches in like Latin America, like you went to, Dustin, and the churches here in America?
No. Yeah, okay. No, Latin America's that's totally separate. Completely separate.
All right.
Yeah. But man, that's a definitely a different experience than I had with Adventist schools.
Yeah.
So how long did you attend that school?
I attended that school. It was the first school that I attended all the way into, I think it was the fourth grade. And my mother was very interested in making sure that my math and science, interestingly enough, was cared for. And when you take a look at least back then, you know, I don't want to say back then it was all about creationism, and mm-hmm. you know, it's been a long time. So there's, you know, I know some churches have loosened up when it comes to, they're a little bit more tolerant when it comes to the idea of evolution, although they may not accept it, or they'll say, yeah, we accept it, but the first cause is God, et cetera, blah, blah. And, you know, my mother was really interested in, because I had an affinity for math and sciences. And so in the fifth grade, she decides that, you know, she's going to find a school that is still religious, you know, good private parochial school, still a very strong biblical sense associated with the teaching, but will also provide me with the ability to excel in math and science. And so she decided to put me in a Lutheran school, right? Now,
this is great.
Yeah. It's like, you know what? How could I not be an atheist, you know, by now? I mean, I've been exposed to them all. And every Sunday, and I was in church, you know, I prayed more than Muslims at one point. it really was. You wake up, you pray, you know, every time you eat, you pray, you know, you go to bed, you pray. And I was like, wait, this is more than five times a day. I'm getting the short end of the stick here. So I went to, it was St. Mark's Lutheran School, also in Brooklyn, and it was predominantly a black school, black Lutheran school, but the church was predominantly white, but the school was black, the church was white. That was interesting. And then the pastor and his wife were also very white. They were traditional Southern Christians that had moved to New York for work. And, you know, I remember Miss Nordine, she was my seventh grade teacher. Man, she was a hard ass too. she really, really was. And she said she wanted to be a nun all growing up. I was like, ugh, well, that explains a whole lot, nun. She really was the gatekeeper in the school itself, and she set the tempo and the tenor for the school, and it was set very rigorously. We had a principal by the name of Mr. Goldberg, just a phenomenal individual who happened to be African American, was very much tied to the civil rights movement, at least in the North, and he was very pro. Know yourself, understand the struggle, understand that you are more than us. Like, I swore that, you know, every time that he spoke, you know, Jesse Jackson grew wings or something. I was like, come on, man. but he would really engender that sense of pride and accomplishment when he spoke to us, and with a lot of the black young men that we had, where we didn't have a multicultural curriculum in New York City per se, he made sure that aspects of multiculturalism were in our hands, right? So always we're going to be talking about history. We're going to be talking about all of everyone's contributions, not to just American history, but African history, European history, et cetera. The story of Hannibal, I think the very first time I heard that, wasn't in high school. It was actually in this school. We got to talk about it, et cetera. Mm. When we talked about civil rights as not just an era, but a continuing movement, things like that were very instrumental in making sure that I had the kind of confidence that I would need when dealing with some of the struggles that I knew that I would face in the future. I mean, you need a little bit of that swagger. You need a little bit of that confidence. If you don't believe in yourself, no one else is going to believe you. Those kinds of things that help, you know, get me through the remaining 20 some odd years that it's been since I've left the school. And really very much taught me not to be afraid of intelligence, and don't be afraid of my intelligence. Don't be afraid to challenge anyone. And that's it's funny because we still had this biblical grounding. And when it came to the civil rights movement or the civil rights era, there's no way that you can get away from the idea of God. I mean, you just can't, mm-hmm. right? Even yeah. though it takes a significant amount of dissonance to say, I mean, is this the same God that allowed everything else to happen pre-civil rights that we are now thanking for letting us be free of those things that he didn't seem to give a shit about before? I mean, it's one of those.
Yeah, the God who the best he could say on slavery yeah. was, don't beat your slave to death.
Right.
Yeah, here's the size of stick you can use.
Right, right. Hmm. And so I went from there into math and science were very, very interesting to me. And I went to school wanting to study math and science. I actually went to a public school, a magnet school in New York. It's called the Bronx High School of Science. And it was the first time that I got to meet people of other religions, outside of Christendom, the first real Muslim, and I'm not talking about, the 5%ers or the Nation of Islam. I'm talking about seeing turbans, seeing the hijab, seeing women that had the blue eyes and wearing that. That was very different to me, being exposed to atheists and agnostics. And honestly, I could not compute the idea of there being someone who didn't believe in some type of God. It just did not make sense to me. It was completely foreign.
Mm-hmm.
You got to believe in something.
I believe in myself.
Well, yeah. It's a little different now.
I totally, right? I totally remember that. Thinking, and just like what you said, Wesley, believing that atheists just worship themselves, made themselves God.
Oh, no, I don't even go that far. I know I'm a dick. Shit.
But yeah, it was, the confidence of not being or not having to back down. I don't remember the first time someone gave me the proverbial bloody nose on my belief. I think it was probably freshman year. When we're outside and we're talking about my religious beliefs, because you know what, why not? And I'm ready to defend them. I'm ready to go at it. I actually still had a Bible in my bag, a little small one in my bag. I carried it, and so it wasn't. One of my friends referred to me at the time as like, "Look, it's the rogue altar boy." that name stuck for a little bit.
About how old were you at the time?
I would say it was about 14 years old, 13, 14 years old when okay. I was taking on seniors and ready to quote Bible and verse. And I mean, I'm talking to, kids with IQs that are ridiculous and they're completely steeped in the idea of debate and they've seen the world and I am now leaving my segregated, and it was, I mean, still, this was late 80s, early 90s. But, reality is we still live in a very, very segregated country. Mm-hmm. It's not legally segregated, but, not everyone has the ability to go up and down the social ladder and move out of their assigned slots.
And by your mom pulling you out of the public school system, that also kept you into segregated environments.
Absolutely. And then my belief, my belief system was completely crafted for me. I was literally spoon-fed. When I had doubts, when I had questions, when I went to the leaders in the SDA church, there were no questions, right? There were no questions. There was just fear. When I went to my pastor in the Lutheran church, his response to me was, well, you know, we all deal with doubt and you'll find your way. And then when I would deal with my own personal priest, you know, I would have these questions for him. I go back as far as Genesis and literal creationism, and I would say, hey, I'm having issues with Genesis and Exodus. I'm having issues here. And his response was, well, nobody actually believes that. I'm like, hold on a second.
Yeah, once you start picking and choosing.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Bad road to go down.
Yeah. Well, the Catholic Church, though, has it easy with that because they have tradition and dogma, not doctrine and what the rest of Christianity has. And yeah. So it's all very fluid, and tradition and dogma outrank the Bible.
Yeah.
That's also how they're so successful holding people in areas like Latin America and Haiti. That's why there was so much of that voodoo being pulled into Catholicism.
Yeah.
It's a fluid tradition.
Yes. Yes. Highly adaptable. And it shows that I had friends who, you know, Santa Maria was nothing that was uncommon at all in my neighborhood. Voodoo itself was something that was not uncommon at all. But we call ourselves Catholic, right? Because it fit.
Let's stop for a quick break, and then we'll pick up right back there. We love hearing from our listeners. You can email us at contact@atheistnomads.com, tweet us @atheistnomads, send us a message on our Facebook page at facebook.com/atheistnomads, or better yet, call us and leave us a message at 541-203-0666. We might even play it on the show. You can also help us out by leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast directory of choice.
After getting my ass handed to me, you know, several times in high school on belief, yeah, and having my confidence kind of shaken, I actually started to engage people in actual dialogue. So it wasn't me trying to defend myself or my belief, me trying to gang up on them and convince them that they're wrong. I really tried to understand their beliefs. I didn't realize that in doing so, that I would gain tremendous tolerance and understanding and empathy, but it was really what helped undo a lot of my own personal faith. I think it was really about junior year or so that I had my first real crisis of faith in Catholicism, and I was having real problems with not just the Catholic. I mean, I was already a confirmed Catholic. Did I really believe what I thought I believed? Mm-hmm. I was having serious issues, stuff that kept me up all night. And in trying to find a lot of those answers, I actually spent time with some of my Muslim friends. And I don't know how it happened, but I actually converted to Islam for a while.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm telling you, I went the whole gamut. And
I don't know. Were you ever a Jew?
No, I never did that. So no. I did not do that.
The chosen people.
Yeah. A few friends have told me, you know, there's still time. I was like, well, you know what? No, I'm good. And
wow. So now you're getting indoctrinated into your fourth very distinctive tradition.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
But it's a continuation. And when you take a look at Judaism, and if you take just a macro view of it, and you make sure that the conflicts kind of don't overlap all that much, the story started in Judaism. It continued in Christianity. And if you spend a little bit of time listening to what Muslims say, it's really just a continuation of tradition. So for me, it was where Christianity was missing. I was able to pick up a lot of that in Islam. And so for about a year and a half, you know, that was what I was studying. I had actually moved in for several months with a my mom was not very happy with this idea, but I had moved in with a Muslim family that was helping me through, and I had actually started learning, you know, how to read the Quran and the Hadith, and really try and wrap my head around it. And, you know, I was praying less as a Muslim than I was as a Catholic.
Nice. How did that happen?
I was like, hey, that's good. It's a break, you know. But I think there was a strong pull back to tradition for me. I felt as if I had violated an understanding that I had with my family, right? Because we'd always been Catholic, or we'd always been Christian. And so although I dabbled in Islam and I was really trying to find my way through Islam, and my family was tolerant of me exploring other beliefs, because as long as I believed in our God, the same God, didn't matter what vantage I took, as long as I believed in that God, I was good. I was always going to be saved, right? And so we walked, you know, I walked that journey. And I got to a precipice. I want to say it was about senior year, where the answers weren't good enough, right? And I looked back and I spent time really reflecting. I became a little bit more introverted. I don't want to say that I was dealing with you know, mild depression, but I was very, very lost, because I really had challenged everything that I had, and I was like, okay. What do I call myself now, right? Because I'm not sure I believe. And based on, you know, more conversations with my pastor, with my minister, with the priest, the answer was really clear to me that I just had not thrown myself into my studies, my religious studies, hard enough. There wasn't enough rigor. And so, you know, first year after that, you know, what do? Join seminary. Good idea.
Wow. So Catholic seminary?
Catholic seminary, St. Matt. actually it was St. John's, excuse me, went to church of St. Matt. I was gonna be all in. It only lasted a few months and I was done. It was really very simple for me, because when we started approaching the Bible as is, and we started to look at it differently, and I didn't realize at the time that when you're really studying the Bible in a way that allows you to teach it, because eventually that's what priests do, they will console and give continence, you know, via the Bible. They have to be able to teach it. You approach the Bible a little bit differently. And when you're doing that, I kind of wanted to understand more of how the Bible was made, how was written, more of the history behind the Bible, and not just the book itself, but what were the motivations behind it? What fell out of the Bible? What made it into canon, and why? And I started studying a little bit of that, and man, that was it. Mm-hmm. That was it. I was done. And it's kind of funny, because almost 50% of my class was like, yeah, we're not going to do this either. I'm like, oh, okay. So
you know, the part that made it in is interesting, but the part that got left out is so much more interesting to me.
Yeah. Oh, yes, man. It is.
When I was my seminary education, I got to do a class. I scored high enough on Greek that I got to do the New Testament honors track. And so it was all electives. I did a seminar in Gnosticism where we were reading the actual Nag Hammadi Gospels.
Yeah.
Shit.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how old were you at this point?
I was in college at the time. So I am what, 19 years old? 19. And that's almost where my button got pushed, it got paused, right? So on my religious, I wouldn't call myself an atheist. I called myself spiritual, but not religious. No. Oh yeah, I was that guy. You know,
Did you hit New Age?
No, I didn't do New Age because that might have been too close to, you know, funky, weird woo stuff for me. Or, you know, and at the time, of course, not really understanding Satanism and potential devil worship. I didn't realize what my beliefs really were. I didn't want to face what those beliefs really were either, right? Because I knew one thing. I didn't believe in any of this anymore. I didn't want to know what I was. I didn't want to call myself the A word because that wasn't there. There's no way that was going to fly. Mm-hmm. Not in my community, not in my church. I still went to church. I went with my family. I went with, you know, I wound up getting married a few years later. And you know, it's just something that you did. You know, it was part of the culture. And in the Afro-Caribbean and African-American communities, you need that, right? Because where are you going to get the good men? Where are you going to get, you know, all these social benefits that the community offers? Well, I mean, you walk into the door in church and hey, it's right there. It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because the church tells you how bad you are, but when you want to feel good, you go to the same place. So it's a one-stop shop for everything.
And if they're the ones that meet all your needs.
Exactly. Even though that they're the ones that are making you, you know, feel ill in the first place, it doesn't matter, right? You're going to keep going. It's a really bad case of spiritual heroin. And I kind of walked away, but I had one foot in the door. My wife at the time was very, very, still very, very religious. And I had my first two children, and I have too many now. I tell people how many kids I want. It's like, what? You're Black Mormons? Like, no, I'm cursing the son of him. So no, I'm not a Mormon. I kept going to church and I kept taking the kids to church. They were in it and they were going through the motions. I don't know whether my son was just picking up on the idea that, you know, dad is just here to be here and what have you. And my wife at the time knew that, you know, I was done with church. It was a chore at that time. But again, when it came to the connections with community and the connections with job opportunities, networking, et cetera, it was the church. Now, at this time, I had relocated from New York to Texas. And of course, being in Texas, you know, this was several years ago, almost what, 18 years ago. It hasn't been that long. It's really hard to be socially mobile and not rely on the church, right? Especially when you're new. You need something that's going to ground you into the community, and why not a church, right? Mm-hmm. You know, right now we've got Meetup and all that other fun jazz, but that didn't exist back then. So default was the church, and so I did the church and kept doing the church. And let's see, it wasn't, again, spiritual but not religious, and that was okay with my family. But not really my mom. My mother was not okay with me being, you know, she knew that I was just doing the thing where I just showed up, and 'cause I stopped doing communion, right? If you don't believe it, I mean, why would I do that? I stopped doing communion.
And that, especially Catholic
that
mass.
Wasn't okay. Yeah.
Catholic
yeah.
mass, they tell you it's a curse.
Yeah. So it's really hard for a parent, and I can say that as a parent, if you believe that your child is going to hell, a place of eternal damnation, or that you're going to heaven and you're never going to see this child again, and you spent the majority of your life raising and caring for this child, just for this child to be discarded in God's eyes, I mean, that's got to hurt. Not only that, you absolutely feel as if you're a failure. You have let this child down. You've let God down. And that's one of the things that I don't like about religion, because of what it does to people's relationships with their family.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't use the A word. And then it was September 13th, 2 days after September 11th, is I think I actually used the word September 12th. I got a call on the 11th, and there was a friend of mine that calls like, hey, did you happen to see what just happened? And I was like, what are you talking about? It was late night before, and grabbed my phone, and now I'm watching the first tower, and then I'm watching the second tower. We know the events that occurred. Of course, me being a New Yorker with still deep roots in New York, friends, family, etc., I was very, very concerned about what could potentially happen. The towers fell. Communications was, you know, kind of went to hell really quick, and I went through a period of not being able to communicate with family and friends and find friends. And so I was actually on one of the first flights that was allowed into LaGuardia, you know, after September 11th. And boy, was it a talk about security. But it wasn't too long after that where I did begin to verbalize exactly where I was when people would ask me. And I think I've told the story before several years ago that had it been 20 years earlier, I would have been really struggling, you know, trying to find a way to make these people on the street feel better, right, about what happened, right? Where my drive to become a priest, you know, and alleviate people's suffering and pain, I would have run to the people that were crying in the street and saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Well, when I walked down church in Vesey, and I got off the train really very early, because I was like, look, I'm going to make it down to the square. I'm going to make it down to the hospital. I'm going to go see, if any of the pictures have been posted yet. I've got to do this myself. So I got off the train really, really early and said, okay, I'm just going to walk the rest of the way because I've got to psychologically prepare myself for this, which you can't, by the way. Mm-hmm. But I'm walking through, you know, downtown Manhattan, lower Manhattan, and I'm seeing these people and the upset and the anger and the despair. And really the first thing that came to my mind was, I don't have to excuse a God that allowed that to happen because I don't believe in it. So I no longer have to defend. And that's one of the things that I would have had to do as a priest. I would have had to defend, look into some of these families' eyes and say, I let this happen. Your God let this happen, but it's going to be okay. And mm-hmm. all the suffering that you're going to deal with from now until you find them or you never find them, that's okay because there's payback.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing is, I went through learning what Islam was. So I understood some of the motives behind what those Muslims did. I kind of get it. Right. There's no justification for it. You got to be kind of sick and twisted to want to do that. But if you understand culturally why they wanted to do it, some of the religious importance of why they wanted to do that, you understand that it's the same God. How can it be the same God? How can you pledge fealty to a God that would allow that? Whether you're Christian and say there's a reason, there's a cause, or whether you're Muslim and say you have a God that condones it. I didn't have to fight that. I didn't have to play that game. I didn't have to go through that level of dissonance, that level of torture that I would have had to deal with had I been a priest at that time. And so it was right then and there that I realized how truly freeing being able to say, hey, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in this. Let's talk about your real suffering. What do you need from me now?
Yeah.
You need, and it was, and for one person, it was just stand with me. Like, okay. And I found people that would say, will you pray with me? It's like, I won't pray with you, but I'll be here right here while you do. And I'll be listening. And for them, that was enough. Again, I didn't have to be the deity or the God to answer those prayers, nor did I have to be one of his henchmen. So that's when I used the word atheist, and I've used it every day since, and I've never shied away from it.
It's so freeing, you know, just no baggage, just love it.
All right, it's time for another break, and then we'll be back with a little bit more current stuff.
Yeah. If you like the show, consider giving us some financial support. To make it really easy with one-time donations, or to support us on a per-episode, monthly, or even annual basis using PayPal or Patreon, find out more at atheistnomads.com. Use the links on the right side of the page. $1 an episode is all we ask. Please, think of the kittens.
All right, we've gotten through to you actually using the A word now. a mature adult, at least into this millennium.
Yep.
And so how did you go from there, finally admitting to yourself you're an atheist, to being such a heavily involved activist?
Being a parent had a very big influence in my level of visibility and activism in the atheist community. I had really... You know, with my family, with my mom and family back east, you know, the word was out, Alex is an atheist, and he's going to keep using it. And that had created a wall between, you know, New York and as if the 1,300 mile distance wasn't enough. I created a wall. Don't tell Perry that, he would love that. He's just going to use that, or even Trump, like a 1,300 mile wall between. Yeah, no, I. Between New York and Texas, not Texas and Mexico, idiot.
Hey, don't leave out Canada. He's not.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That's true. Oh man. and you know, my mother had gotten to the point where we just weren't talking. It was done. I was for almost a decade. I was dead to her. You know, and and. That meant that I needed to rally my family. I mean, she wasn't talking to my kids either, right? I was leading them into the gates of hell personally, right? And, you know, being able to say that, hey, I'm an atheist, and my kids were saying, hey, yeah, we're pretty sure we don't believe in any of that stuff too. And I didn't want them to use the term atheism until they really understood what it meant, especially because of the connotation that it had in the African American community or in the community at large. And I had remarried at the time, and my wife was very much, you know, hey, wouldn't it be great if there was something that was like church without God? Like, yeah, that'd be awesome. I doubt it exists. Now, this is before Sunday Assembly or anything like that. And we found a very small group in Dallas. It was called the North Texas Church of Free Thought. And we started attending. And it was kind of cool. It was very, very small. And a few of the families there wanted to focus more on family building and what have you. And focus on the kids and what we could provide the kids. So several of us, about 20 of us, broke off and created another sect, right? So it was, yes, a reformation, right? So we started what is the Fellowship of Free Thought, which is the largest free thinking group in I actually think it's in Texas at this point. Might be the Humanist of Houston, might be really close. But we started that, and the focus was on you know, a little bit of diversity and making sure that it was very open and what have you. And we were interested in bringing Camp Quest to Texas. Which was kind of crazy at the time. Like, could you really bring a secular camp to Texas? My kids absolutely wanted to do it. They said, if you get it here, we will attend. And we got it here. And the first year that they were there, you know, both my kids were there and they had a phenomenal time. And it was news, right? Because this was new. It was very, very different. Secular kids, Texas, you got to be kidding me. right? Because what does that mean to the churches? They're coming for your kids, right?
Hell,
exactly,
yeah.
What it means. They're coming for your kids. And my son did an interview. I was like, you sure? Because this could potentially, you know, be an issue for you later on. And he's like, no, I want to do this, right? I mean, I had already begun putting myself out there a little bit, and I was becoming more vocal. And he said, hey, I want to do this. And he did. And he did a video, and we didn't hear anything about it for several months. And so we thought, hey, it was fine. And it was about Christmas or so. He was in public high school at the time in you know, the North Dallas area. And a couple of kids cornered him and, you know, threw him up against the corner, you know, shook him down. He did get hit. And he said what they told him was like, hey, we saw you on the news. We saw a clip of you on the news and your interview. So explain to me exactly how you can be black and be an atheist. I mean, you got to believe in Jesus. And so they roughed him up a little bit. The school did take disciplinary actions and what have you. So I didn't have any real issues with the school or the administration at the time. But what stuck with me and it really bothered me, it kept me up at night, was this assertion that you can't be black and be an atheist, though it's incoherent, right? It's incompatible.
It's
rare, but it happens. I mean, what happened before Christianity? Well, you had a lot of, you know, very different beliefs and believers, and you had non-believers too, right? I mean, mm-hmm. They've always been there. And I decided that I was going to become much more active, much more vocal in talking to the African-American community and to the Afro-Caribbean community about agnosticism and free thought and atheism. And it just so happened that I had a friend, an American atheist, who introduced me to a couple of reporters and said, hey, let me help you get this story out. It's not something that we're talking about. One thing led to another. A couple of news articles get released, my name attached to it. And then Ebony Magazine comes knocking on my door and says, hey, we'd like to feature you in Ebony Magazine, which at the time was, again, completely unheard of, because this was the very first time that they've broached the idea of atheism at all in a subscription of over 1 million plus. And so did an interview, had this great conversation with them. And that really set off just several massive domino effect in putting my name out there and having conversations, and almost everything happened afterwards, right?
And you got an awesome billboard with you in Langston.
Yeah, that one actually came, I want to say about almost 2 years later, where again the Ebony Magazine piece really did help get my particular story out there. The NPR story was probably the best one. But when CFI decided that they were going to do, this is the Center for Inquiry, the Council for Secular Humanism, has the AAH, the African American for Humanism Initiative, which focuses on bridging the gap between the African American communities and minority communities and free thought. You know, Todd Stiefel, you know, really helped bankroll that. And I mean, he was awesome, and I'm going to be forever grateful to him for that. But Debbie Goddard really helped pull that all together. And it was about 11 or 12 cities, and it was truly a national campaign. And I got paired up with Langston Hughes, which was funny because it was some of his readings as I was leaving religion that helped me come to terms and come to grips with what I might be, right? Goodbye Christ. Goodbye Christ. I almost recommend Goodbye Christ to anyone who is Black and really doesn't think that, you know, you might have doubts. Well, go read Goodbye Christ, and you might see how historically we've always had questions and concerns about Christianity, religion, and Christendom. So I got paired up with Langston Hughes, and of course, being in Texas, in the heart of the South, in, I mean, truly deep Bible Belt, this exploded, right? There were 11 other billboards out there, but the one in Dallas absolutely exploded, right? And it just happened to be just a couple of miles away from T.D. Jakes' church. And so, completely accidentally that, you know, but it was really good position. And, you know, a lot of ministers were really upset, but it started tremendous dialogue. People were reaching out to me from across the globe. Hey, where can I find groups like yours? You know, I'm in New York and I don't know. I'm in Atlanta and I don't know. I'm in LA and I don't know. And so it was great. And so we have seen a tremendous amount of groundswell from that campaign that has just rippled across, you know, just year after year. You know, two becomes four, becomes eight, becomes, you know, exponentially larger. And believe it or not, I didn't really want to bring Black non-believers to Dallas simply because I was afraid of the potential marginalization that would happen. Like, oh, look, there's only five of them. But but I did change my mind a little bit because there was such a demand. There were people that was like, hey, we want to meet, we want to do this, and if we don't meet, let's at least connect. And online, there's a thriving African American community of non-believers and agnostics and atheists, and including the anti-theists as well. There's a lot of those. But it's just been, like I said, a tremendous groundswell, which has allowed me to get involved in a lot of other, other projects. And again, you know, Mandisa Thomas has been just absolutely amazing with taking the message of Black non-believers from just Black non-believers Atlanta into a, I want to say that we're either at 10 or 11 cities right now, and we're growing, you know, DC, Detroit, Dallas, Atlanta proper. I mean, so there's Chicago, there's a lot of momentum and still demand for, we need those groups. And unfortunately, you still do need those groups. I'd love to be able to say that, you know, Black non-believers or people of color, were comfortable in just walking into a humanist group, but it's not always the most welcoming, and there are issues that always come up that makes it really difficult to bridge. So we still need those safe spaces until we can either grow to a tipping point where we see massive crossover into a lot of the humanist groups, and I actually see that in Dallas. You know, many of the, you know, Black non-believers in Dallas, they you know, have no issues whatsoever crossing over into the general assembly of, or the big tent atheist groups. But there's still this, can we still have our own safe space where we can have, I don't want to say come to Jesus meetings, but but meetings where we can really talk and let our guards completely down and talk dirty and talk dirt.
Do you think it's the fact that there is a specifically Black group that's making it easier for Black atheists to get involved with the broader community? Or is it just that there's enough out there Black atheists that there's a critical mass?
So I think the groups enable critical mass, right? So you have, you know, think of it as just one magnet. And you have, and they're little poles, right? You have just little magnets here and there, and they wind up pulling the groups. You know, I have people that will drive 30, 40, 50 miles, you know, occasionally to come do an event. And then, you know, same thing I hear from other BN organizations and other Black non-believers groups. So there is enough critical mass in those groups where they feel safe enough that, hey, I still have this and I can keep my one foot in. And then I can spill over into the broader atheist community. Now, I will say that quite often it is a very toxic or caustic community for, I mean, we talk about women in general. You know, sometimes we deal with a lot of misogyny and sexual harassment. But when you start looking at minorities specifically, there tends to be some issues there as well. So it's very, very caustic.
Worse than just cultural differences?
No, I think it is cultural differences, but the problem is an expectation that we don't have those cultural differences, right? The idea of being colorblind, for instance.
Oh.
Right. I don't see color. Can't you be you know, you're a humanist and what have you? You know, why do you need the term Black atheist? Can't you just be an atheist? It's like, well, yeah, if the rest of the world, you know, operated that way, sure. But if not, you know, you're denying a lot of my reality. And unfortunately, people don't see that.
Yeah. And like you've brought up numerous times, within just the Black community, you've got Afro-Caribbean and African-American. There's a wide variety of cultures represented yeah. within that subset.
Yeah.
Now, like one thing I've seen in Boise, we've had at various meetings I've gone to, maybe, man, 3 or 4 Black people show up ever.
Yeah.
But this is also an area where the vast majority of Blacks are Somali refugees.
Yeah.
So the population, it'd be difficult to create that here. Whereas like what we need here is a ex-Muslim group and a Hispanic group.
Yep.
And one other area I do want to get into is why is okay, we've already covered part of why Black atheists is a big deal, but what's the part about the Black community? Why is it that some people think that those are incongruent ideas?
Because culturally it's something that we don't talk about. It's been very, very taboo. There are a lot of theories that that suggest that it goes as far back as slavery, right? I mean, there's the humility associated with traditional values, right? There's always got to be something greater than you, so there's always going to be this God creator. I mean, how could there not be? Look at the world around you. There has to be grand design. And I think part of it is the legacy of slavery specifically. And we see a lot of that, you know, that just hasn't gone away. Again, it's a throwback to tradition where you had Christianity beat into you, right? I mean, there were no choices. And so you gave that to everyone else and it became part of the racial identity, which is already somewhat fractured in America when you start looking at African Americans. It is, you know, I want to say it was W.E.B. Du Bois who talked about the veil of double consciousness and how when you look at the Black Negro conscious, it is very, very different because you have to see yourself through different lenses. And so when you're trying to cohere what that identity is, there can be a separation of church and state, but there can't be a separation of church and race. I mean, it's part of, again, it's part of Black identity. Culturally, there are certain things that are in the media that keep this idea of what this identity is, you know, very strictly religious. When you take a look at cultural icons that continuously reaffirm their thanks to a God, whether it is on stage or you know, after a ball game or whatever it is, it's still thrown back to, mm-hmm. I have to thank a God or a master. It's also really disturbing to see so many, it was after the massacre in Carolina where we saw the families talking about forgiving people and they were relying on God to help with the healing, et cetera. Nowhere else would you see such a thing, right? It's just unheard of. And it is because of the fractured identity of African Americans. I can say that because I study psychology a lot. So you can send the hate mail to alex@dogmindabend.com. There you go.
Send all the hate mail to Smalley at
Dogmindabend. Yeah, well, he sends it to me anyway. So whether it's aimed at me or not, I get it all. So yeah.
Yeah, but so many of the great civil rights leaders were preachers.
Yeah, of course. And so, of course, let my people go. So you have Moses, and Moses, and then there was the other Moses. And so when you start taking a look at the civil rights movement, it's Dr. Reverend, Reverend, Dr. Reverend, Dr. Reverend. Guy. So you have that, and you forget the other drivers in the civil rights movement. You forget the Langston Hughes. You forget. I mean, there are so many secular names. A. Philip Randolph. People that made things happen and said, you done praying because we got work to do. That's what they were there for, right? Liberation during the civil rights movement would not have happened if it was nothing but preachers. But we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Right? We don't talk about that because, if it was up to Martin, he'd still be praying, right? He's like, no, you got to get up off the knees and we got a march. The march wasn't his idea. We talk about Selma. That wasn't his idea, all right? When it came down to, and I'm not taking anything away from the man, I'm just saying there's a lot of credit to spread around, right? And the one guy that we really tend to gloss over who was not Christian, who had a significant impact on the idea of Black liberation, and you see it today. You see it today with the Black Lives Matter people almost constantly, is Malcolm.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right? He uttered words that still ring true today and piss off a lot of people. But, there's a reason why the Black Lives Matter activists have no issues running up in front of someone and disturbing, right? Disturbing a political rally or whatever. And there's no surprise that some of those folks, although I wish they would all come out already, are also secular. There's no surprise at all that they're secular, right? Because they're not tied to this idea of authoritarian benevolence or behavior or obedience associated with authority. And Malcolm uttered one sentence that still drives a lot of them, and that's by any means necessary. And that is what drives them still today.
Yeah. And how much of the church's hold over the Black community is just tied to the standard, or not necessarily standard, but the common socioeconomic disadvantages?
A lot. Next question.
So if we could fix all of the socioeconomic problems, do you think Black atheists would be as common as white atheists?
I don't know if it would be as common, but I would say that you would see, you probably see a little bit more parity, but
I was going to ask about parity myself. Do you think if atheist outreach programs could be more like churches in the things that they offer, help and services, that there would be less of a pool to keep that community going?
Man, did you read one of my speeches? This sounds like one of my talks, actually. Yes, actually, I've spoken about that in one of the plans, on how do you change the face of humanism and begin to reflect the diversity that is actually out there, especially when you look at those that are downtrodden or suffering. And you have to go into places where you're uncomfortable going. And that's something that the secular community has not traditionally been able to do, right? Well, you know, you meet in areas and places that you're comfortable in, and you do charity in places that you're comfortable in. And so you're never really bridging that. So when we start talking about outreach, you've got to get your hands really dirty, and you've got to cross that. You have to cross the other side of the tracks and go talk to them. Now, if you're doing it correctly, you're not seen as, you know, oh, look, there's another white savior. We already got those. Thank you very much. See you later. But you're there in a in not necessarily an advisory capacity, but just to help. Hey, here, I'm Alex, and I'm here to help. What do you need?
I got some hands. Can you use them?
I got some hands. Can you use them? But you can't be the face of that, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot be the face of that because they won't trust you. I wouldn't trust you, right? I know what you sold me before. I'm looking at the results of it, right?
It's all right. I wouldn't trust me either.
And so it's like, and if you show me a boat ticket, I'm running. But
fuck. Oh, wow.
I was going to try and not use one, but yeah, why not?
God damn it.
But okay. Yeah. Okay. So, So you gotta show up, but you gotta show up correctly. You've got to be able to be silent. You've got to be able to stand behind someone and sometimes putting your ego completely aside. You've got to be able to create a platform and then walk away. And sometimes you have to be able to let organizations that you help build fail, because that process of failing sometimes inspires more. So there's a lot of discussion that should and could be had with workshops with secular groups on how you do outreach properly and build the bridges between the minority community and secular, because there's so much there that we could and should be doing. And if you are able to put the distance between them and the church, or close the gap between you and them, which is actually more crucial, then you'll see more people start coming in. But you've got to also be able to replace some of those services, which is really, really, really hard. And we deal with different realities, right? Unemployment is what, less than 10% in the United States? Well, it's closer to 50% in the African-American community. So you have
these...
Yeah. So you're dealing with really, really different numbers and very different realities. And so you need someone that understands those differences when you're trying to really bridge that.
Yeah. And that would apply to other minority groups as well. I would not be able to reach the Hispanic community here in the Treasure Valley. About half of them are migrant farm workers.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of them don't speak English.
Right. So here's the numbers that, you know, everyone was jumping up and down at the last Pew survey, right? And I gave it, you know, a slow clap while everyone else was, you know, popping Cristal and everything. I'm like, yeah, I don't. Yeah. When you look at the numbers, it's about 30% of the general population shows that they are becoming more and more secular. If you take a look at the projections and start extrapolating out, we think that over the next 5-10 years, that number could hit as close to 50%. I doubt it. But, depending on the model that you look at and trust, so like, look, this is good news. When you start digging into some of the demographics, you say, okay, look at what happened with women, right? Specifically. And it's like, you know, you're pushing that 50% mark of those people that are secular, say that they're women. That's great. When you take a look at the Latino community, again, you're seeing 8% and upwards of 8% or more that identify as secular, so not necessarily religious. And so everyone's like, this is great. This is progress. There was no change in the African-American community. No change.
Mm.
Nothing. Nada. Zero.
Wow.
Zilch.
Churches hold such a stranglehold on the community.
Again, it's also part of your cultural identity, right? And it is absolutely a stranglehold.
Yeah. And okay, with Hispanics, they've got something that, that blacks don't. There's been a huge shift over the last 20, 30, 40 years from Catholicism to charismatic.
Yes.
Especially charismatic.
Yes. Yes.
That would weaken the religious hold right there.
That whole thing about moving to a new area and first thing somebody asks you is like, hey, what's your name? And second is, what church you go to?
Yeah.
And third is, come to mine.
Right, right. Yeah, but so one of the things that is kind of cool, that does give me a little bit of a glimmer of hope is when talking about, you know, maybe we don't see a tremendous shift or growth to secularism in the African American community specifically per se, but we are seeing more visibility within the African American community. So, you know, you are seeing atheist voices that are just getting louder. They've found their voices, they've found microphones, and it is becoming more commonplace to hear or talk about atheist, which was at one point completely taboo, but it's becoming less so. So I don't want to paint too grim of a picture because I think that that's the beginning of change. And if we can get the rest of the numbers to shift, and we can actually begin to address, the inequality, the wealth inequality, we can talk about the despair, we can talk about the unemployment, we can talk about the issues that keep the church so strong and thriving within the African American community. If we can address those, we can begin to sever the instinctual ties, maybe not the ancestral ties. Maybe we can clip the cultural umbilical cord, and that would be a great win for us, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man.
Wow.
So, Alex, got anything to pimp? Like, what's some good projects? Something that we can...
Me. I'll pimp me all day. No.
You can't even... You have turtles reaching over the counter. What are you talking about? You.
What? Yeah.
Oh, come on. Yeah, short person jokes.
Yeah, we talked about height before we started the show, since nobody else knows what that was just about.
just let it fly. Let it float. Just hang there like a bad turd.
What can I pimp? Well, one is, man, I've got so many things going on. One is, if you ever need someone, if someone needs help, you can always reach out to assistance via Secular Avenue. That's a project that I'm working with Noel George and company. Noel being the new person in charge of the Foundation Beyond Belief. Thank you very much for taking that job. She's a wonderful person, just all around. So I'm very glad to be working with her. And Secular Avenue is focused on finding people a safe route to autonomy. So whether you're a teen or what have you, who is in the LGBT community and you don't feel safe coming out, there are other charities out there that will help you, but we can help you as well. If you are in a domestic abuse or potentially violent or controlling relationship and you're secular and you're trying to find your way out, we help with that as well. Again, that's secularavenue.org. So that's the first project. Okay, if you're in Dallas.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that right there is probably my favorite my favorite project. Black Nonbelievers is something that I believe in pretty heavily. Regardless of where you're at, there's probably a group that is forming, has formed, has announced, whatever. They do meetups, I think it's the first and third weekend, first and third Sundays of every month, you can usually find something going on with the Black Nonbelievers group. So if you find your way to support that, BN Inc. is still fundraising, trying to get more supplies and stuff like that out there to many of their affiliates. So that's two. And let's see, two other things that I'm working on. One is my blog specifically at Pathios, and that's the graffiti wall. I'm always causing trouble there. So be prepared. Seriously, be prepared to, I don't want to say be offended, but you're probably going to be challenged. I don't have any issues, you know, challenging conviction and graven images. So whatever you believe, you know, or you think you believe, be prepared to be challenged a little bit. And people can usually find me weekly on Dogma Debate with David Smalley. Again, I'm the funny one.
All right. And links to all of those will be in the show notes.
Cool.
Alex, thank you very much for joining us. This has been overdue and awesome.
Oh, fucking
hell. You're welcome. Yeah, thank you for having me, finally. But yeah, thank you.
Come on, you've never heard of us before.
No, that's so not true. What was his name again?
Yep. Fucking knew it.
God. Alrighty, and for our listeners, we will be back next week with the news.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com, contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com, or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.